Thank you. Toronto was the first place I visited as a kid, and I actually remember. This was my first exposure to the broader world, and so I have very fond memories of Toronto. Of course, over the years, I've forgotten just how cold it is here, but now that has been refreshed. So I apologize, by the way, for not being coordinated enough to provide either a title or an abstract to your booklet. We have a 7-month-old at home who currently has a cold, et cetera, so it's been very confusing. So let's see. Okay. So one of the things I do is direct this Bay Area Physical Sciences Oncology Center. And so this is one of these NCI-funded physical sciences oncology centers. And the notion here is that what one wants to do is to assemble talent from across the fields, so ranging from mathematics to cancer biology and also the clinical world, and force these people to talk more and work together and so forth. And so a lot of the work I'll be talking about really arises out of the work of many people, especially Jamie Sethian in the UC Berkeley math department. So if anything I say is interesting and makes sense to you, it's probably due to any number of these other people, and if you disagree with something, then that's probably something I'm getting wrong or I'm mixing up. To put this in a little bit of a broader perspective, and we just heard about that actually in a beautiful talk just preceding this one, there is this overall high-level trend of personalization. And that's an incredibly powerful idea, and we just heard a number of reasons why this is not so easy to do in practice, perhaps. But more broadly speaking, one of the things one sees is patient-to-patient variation. It's sometimes hard to make sense of genomic data, and again, we now probably understand a little bit better why that is. And also, a number of compounds pulled out in the various high-throughput cell line screens frequently fail in tissues and in the patient. Why is this? Why could this be? And one of the answers seems to be that cancer signaling is significantly modulated by the cell's environment. And so let's do a few thought experiments to see how this might work and if this might be true and so forth. Here's a quick thought experiment due to Timothy Newman. Here's a picture of a cell and the extracellular matrix, and for simplicity, I've denoted the plasma membrane. So who here can tell me what's inside and what's outside of the cell? After staring at this for a long time, outside, inside, I'm pretty sure I agree, so I'm pretty sure this is the outside and this is the inside. I don't actually know. I think this is the inside. If you have other opinions, please immediately correct me. And one of the things that this illustrates is that cells are really not these islands onto themselves, but in their natural environment, in the context of a tissue or other cells, the notion of what is inside and outside can be a tricky one. And so, if this is true, if the inside of the cell and the plasma membrane and all these things are intimately connected with the extracellular matrix, then one of the questions one immediately would like to ask is, do mechanics matter? Why is this? Well, if we have mechanical connections between the inside and the outside, this question arises. So let me give you some examples of where we know mechanics matter. And then let us see if we can find more evidence for this in solid tumors. A classic example of where mechanics matter is in enzymology. And so here's an example of taking an enzyme, which is called T7 DNA polymerase, and what you do is you allow it to work on its substrate. So you have this enzyme merrily polymerizing, and as shown by this plot, if the tension on the substrate is low, this is a polymerase. So now I pull on the DNA substrate, and now the enzymatic activity flips to an exonuclease. So if I pull hard on the substrate, it just reverses what it just did, click, 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 go to single strand. I now relax the tension, and the exonuclease flips back to polymerase and polymerizes. So this is a single molecule level, this is a single molecule story of how mechanics control enzymes. Okay. Now, what about a cell-level view of mechanics? Here's a movie of three cells moving through a model extracellular matrix. And this is more similar to what is happening in your body. As you know, you're mostly water. And then second order, you're mostly collagen. And third order, there's also some cells in there. But to a good approximation, you're water and collagen, or water and extracellular matrix. And when we characterize cells, or many of us, we put these cells on glass or something like that. But of course, what is going on inside our body is that these cells are interacting with this spider web-like material. Let me try to play this movie again, just so it's fresh in your minds. Here we go. So here are the cells interacting with this fibrous collagen material. The extracellular matrix is not simply a quote-unquote dumb mechanical scaffold, but as has been clear for a number of years now, stem cells use mechanical cues to make decisions. So what do you think happens if you put a stem cell on something really soft? Well, it will turn into a neural precursor because your brain is a relatively soft tissue. If you stick your finger into brain tissue, it feels like Philadelphia cream cheese. If you put a stem cell on something hard, then of course it's biased towards a bone precursor cell because bones have a much higher, they're much harder, more stiff, higher elastic modulus. So these sort of ideas have broad implications for regenerative medicine and also oncology. Typically, they're investigated in the context of individual cells. I take an individual stem cell, put it on a hard or soft surface, what happens? So what does this really mean about organs and organoids and tumors? Here's a classic experiment from Mina Bissell. What she did is she took a particular cell line, T42 cells. She places them on a normal matrix of some sort, and they develop into cells that any pathologist would call malignant. And she was able to show that she can use any number of control parameters, soluble factors, mechanics, shear stresses, to now drive the system from one phenotype to another. So for example, if I take exactly the same cell line with exactly the same genome, and I provide combinations of those external control parameters, I can revert them in the sense that they now grow into phenotypically normal structures. And what are some of these reversion agents? Some of them target molecules or receptors, for example, integrins that allow the cells to interact. By the way, these are not cells, these are organoids. These are little mammary acini. And so these molecules are targeting integrins, or you can accomplish similar things by softening the matrix, or you can now block reversion with shear stress, and that overrides the chemistry of the soluble factors. So a lot of what is going on here in these kind of reversion experiments and these kind of phenotypic plasticity experiments is that you're looking at the interplay of chemistry and mechanics and the genetics of the system. This is a sort of bedrock experiment due to a Canadian, Valerie Weaver, who some of you will know. This is her PATSEC 2005 paper. She's taking an organized multicellular structure, one of these mammary acini, and she's placing it on substrates with increasing hardness or stiffness, and I can formalize that if you want. What she shows in a dose-dependent manner is that the harder the substrate, the more disorganized your mammary acinus becomes after some time. And of course, you know in breast cancer progression, typically what you see in the tissue is that the tissue hardens. So there's a clinical side to this as well, which I won't get into. So summarizing all the things we've just discussed, the mechanical control of individual enzymes, stem cells using matrix characteristics to make decisions, and entire model tumors or organized multicellular structures also responding to compliance differences. How should we begin to think about this? So if we think about signaling in the normal two-dimensional diagram with things connected by arrows, it's hard to reconcile all these results. But as you're very well aware, signaling is not going on a two-dimensional piece of paper, but it's happening in the three-dimensional membrane where the outside of the cell is connected to the inside of the cell, both chemically, figuratively speaking, and mechanically, literally speaking, where various transmembrane receptors connect the outside with the inside and the force-generating machinery and so forth. And this is possibly how cellular mechanics and contractility and signal processing and microenvironmental factors and so forth all somehow come together in ways that are quite frankly poorly understood. A quick summary of this thumbnail introduction to mechanobiology. So the good news is that to some degree a lot of what has been going on in chemistry and biochemistry and cell biology for decades has in fact been an analysis of mechanobiology or mechanochemistry. And this may be surprising to some people, but the way to think about this is if you're measuring positions, then you're already measuring something that's very important for mechanics, because if you now measure how those things change as a function of time, we all know that that object is directly proportional to forces. So whenever a cell biologist looks at cell shape, whenever a cell biologist looks at changes in cell shape, the movement of interfaces, then they're automatically looking at changes of mechanics, changes of tensional homeostasis, and so forth. If an interface moves, someone is pushing more, or someone is less compliant, or some combination of those things. In fact, if you begin to think about cell biology in that way, then it may turn out to be that one of the reasons why pathology is so powerful is that pathologists use cell and tissue architecture to make statements about disease and to predict outcomes and so forth. And of course, if you use cell architecture and tissue architecture, then what you're implicitly doing is probing mechanics and altered mechanics. And so this is one of the things that may be interesting to make more explicit in what pathologists do. They may be applied mechanobiologists by virtue of them looking at architectures. So that was a little introduction, and let me show you things that are largely unproven but colorful and interesting. And essentially, all of this is due to people like Jamie Sethian, my mathematician colleague, and Valerie Weaver, my Canadian mechanobiologist. And so again, so I'm highlighting the mathematician here just because of where I'm speaking. Let's think about a breast organization for a moment. So where does the milk come from? The milk comes from mammary acini, and they normally secrete milk into the lumen. And then, of course, there's a variety of plumbing and duct work because the milk then needs to leave the breast. And the cells most at risk for malignant transformation are, in fact, cells in the terminal duct lobular units. These are structures, superstructures of mammary acini, which then together would produce milk, which would flow through this duct work. And we've already looked at Valerie's 2005 work relating organization of mammary acini to matrix compliance. The first question, of course, is why doesn't this happen all the time? So just imagine all multicellular structures in a tissue were exquisitely sensitive to altered mechanics. Let's just say I push on something. You know, why is the tissue mostly stable, whatever that means? And so one of the reasons this doesn't always happen is that essentially all structures like mammary acini are shielded from inappropriate chemical cues from collagen 1 and inappropriate mechanical cues from the broader tissue by things like the basement membrane and my epithelial cells. So now we can ask another question. Okay, what if I take an acinus and it loses shielding for whatever reason? So let's just say there's some sort of damage to the basement membrane, something else happens, and now suddenly you start to see altered mechanics. Now suddenly you see things like collagen 1, which is what you'd never see as a happy mammary acinus. So here's a quick movie of taking a relatively happy mammary acini and letting them settle on collagen 1, which they would never normally see. Here it goes. This is about 24 hours. And you have to look at this movie quite a few times, but let me walk you through it. So initially what you saw are five memory acini being placed on the collagen one, and what you see in the course of about 24 hours is you see the entire material deform. If you look closely, you saw a rip right here where you saw material being torn. And the other thing you saw are cells then leaving the structure and flowing along lines of organized collagen to other acini. So there's a lot of things going on here. There are gene expression changes going on here. There is matrix remodeling that's chemical that's going on here. There's mechanical matrix remodeling going on here. And there's a disorganization of a stable multicellular structure into individual highly motile cells that have vimentin, Ki67, YAP-TAZ is in nucleus, and various other things are going on here. So, but let's now put on our physicist or mathematician hat. The general question one would like to ask is, whenever traditionally people look at the intersection of compliance or altered mechanics and cellular or tissue level responses, they typically put cells or acini on materials which cannot be modified by these structures, like polyacrylamide. So what happens if I put a contractile object onto something it can remodel? And what if that material has interesting non-linearities, such as stress hardening? Remember, if I take a polymer and pull on it, there are many polymers that actually become hardened as I pull on them. This is called stress hardening. So are there possibilities for positive feedback and various other things? And the way we approach this as a lab is typically from a measurement perspective. And so the first question is, okay, so if I'm waving my arms a lot and I'm invoking mechanics, the first thing you'd like to be able to do is simply visualize them, right? You want to see them. And it turns out that this may actually be easier than at first thought. Here you saw a movie of a living zebrafish, and the living zebrafish twitched. And all we were measuring was the birefringence of the tissue. And so it turns out that if I take a gel, a polymeric material, and I mechanically stretch it, what I'm doing on a molecular level is aligning the material, and this gives rise to a strain-induced birefringence. And I can directly read that out. So fortuitously, all tissues come with strain gauges, right? They're these polymeric materials, and if I develop appropriate ways of measuring or quantifying the birefringence, I can directly see the mechanics inside the living tissue. This was done the first time 140 years ago or something like that, so I don't want to belabor this. I merely want to point out that with contemporary imaging technologies, especially good cameras and so forth, one can literally pick up these strain-induced birefringences very, very easily. Okay. So now if you now take these measurement tools, and here is a single acinus sitting on some collagen, this is bright field, and if you watch this movie, then you see it gradually disorganize a little bit. You don't see streaming cells. You see a little bit of corrugation around the edges. Let's look at what happens mechanically as the structure is manipulating the collagen. And so very gradually you see alignment of the collagen as this acinar structure is pulling. If the lights were down, we would see this a little bit more clearly. But fortunately, there's movies coming up where this will hopefully become much easier to see. Okay. Okay. So now, because of my physics background, if you start with one hydrogen atom, it's only natural to wonder what happens if I take two hydrogen atoms and bring them together in some proximity. Okay, so here are two of them, and now they're within a few hundred microns of one another, and let's see what their mechanics are. And so from a pathology standpoint, or a morphology standpoint, or phenotype standpoint, one of the things we see, first of all, that these acini disorganize more. You also see cells stream along this mechanically remodeled collagen, and then you see something which is unusual, which is this intense line of birefringence or collagen organization running between the acinar structures. Let us look at a few more of these things, and then let's think about how they arise. This is the actual flow field visualized by fluorescent tracers in the collagen. And what you see is that both acinar structures are sinks, if you think about them as fields, and so the collagen flows towards these sinks. But if you're dealing with a gel, then interesting things happen at the interface between these two acinar structures, and you get a concentration of collagen, and this concentration is this line of collagen is stress hardened. Okay, a few more of these movies just to familiarize yourself with some of the dynamics of these systems. So again, even if I have multiple acini, they begin to form these lines of hard collagen along geodesics. The cells stream along these highways, and now the obvious question is, okay, so these things are pretty, but are they biologically relevant or clinically relevant at all, right? Here, another technology for actually visualizing the long-range deformations due to acinar contractility. What we do here is we've just made a little reagent, which is a collagen binding protein plus photoactivatable amniose-2. So we can write in three dimensions fiducial structures into either collagen gels or living tissues, and then simply watch as these optically patterned fiducials deform as acini or tumors are actively engaging mechanically the extracellular matrix. So how shall we think about what these lines of collagen are? Are they simply regions of concentrated collagen? What's going on there? A quick SEM image, and if you look closely, so here's acinus-1, acinus-2. And the first thing you observe is in regions far away from acini, the collagen has no net alignment. If you zoom in to one of these bundles, what you see are highly aligned collagen, highly aligned regions of collagen, and there's also more diffusely aligned regions of the collagen. So now what happens if I go from one or two or three acinar structures to a group or a flock or a field or however you want to denote this? This is a simple bright field image of on order of 18 or 20 acini. And what do you think is the underlying network diagram? It looks something like this. And so over time, the acini, again, interconnect and they form these lines of hardened collagen. And we can think about this in a network perspective. That's actually very, very hard to do for lots of different reasons. For one thing, these structures are dynamic, so they can appear and disappear. And so it's hard to apply the usual network theory results to these sort of diagrams. Okay, but still, you can say, okay, these are pretty but not so relevant. And so the first question is, we know clinically and through other experiments that inappropriately hardened extracellular matrix materials promote transition to a malignant phenotype and promote disorganization. So the first thing we had to do was show that these lines are actually hard. And so we used an AFM to directly push on these lines of collagen, and you see that in the interfaces between two interacting acini, the elastic modulus is about a factor of 8 increased compared to regions far from any acini or even regions close to individual acini that are not interacting with any other of their friends. There are signal processing responses to that hardening, and that's the movie which unfortunately already played here. This is the YAP-TAS stiffness sensing molecule which is being relocated to the nucleus in the cells which have left the formerly organized structure and are moving along the hardened cables. And so YAP-TAS, as expected, nicely moves into the nucleus. And so now, finally, what you'd like to do is relate this network formation, this inappropriate hardening, these long-range mechanical effects to what the system is doing in terms of a transition to a more malignant phenotype or a less organized phenotype. All that we're plotting here is sphericity, and this measurable has a variety of limitations versus time. And so if I look at the set of paired acini that have a cable running between them versus the S&I that are not mechanically interacting with neighbors, what I typically find is that these dimers or higher order S&R structures start to disorganize faster, they disorganize more quickly, and they have a more sigmoidal appearance than the single S&I. And it could simply be that the single S&I are disorganizing so much more slowly that we never get into a sort of self-limiting time where this reaction also must stop. So experimentally, what we find, if we also look specifically at how S&I disorganize that are talking mechanically to other structures, is that, so this is one of these pairs. And of course, there's a lot of variation. You know, sometimes the two will form a cable and still one of them will be more disorganized than the other, and typically the time difference between them is about half an hour or an hour at most. And so for both of these coupled S&I, you see that their sphericity versus time plot is sigmoidal, and this can be interpreted to denote some sort of positive feedback of some kind, some sort of autocatalysis, and that's still very hand-waving at the moment. So from a mathematics perspective, one of the things we started out being very, very interested in, and we're even more interested in this these days, is to think what is going on here from a purely mechanical viewpoint. And this is where Jamie Suffian comes in. So what we'd like to do with all of these structures is we want to do things like squash them, stretch them, throw them against membranes. We want to change elasticity in places. We want to change various hydrodynamic properties, add regions, remove regions, and so forth. And in response to those manipulations in the computer, or analytically, what we want to know is how do those interfaces move? How does architecture change? What is the structural strength? How do forces propagate inside organized multicellular structures? And so what goes into some of these models are surface tension, advection with permeability, and Navier-Stokes. And anyone can write down these equations or assert that they're important, but it turns out very hard to actually calculate what should happen in three dimensions as a function of time. And so some of the big advances have been on the algorithm side that now allows computers to do a full 3D calculation of what happens to these interfaces as we fiddle with a variety of control parameters. So here's a quick illustration, which is now actually several years old, and gravity is clearly turned up far too high here, just to get this to happen quickly. So we're showing how this is now a calculation. A single S&R structure is now interacting with a material, and all that's going on here is that there's a sort of surface tension difference, and so this S&R structure then adsorbs onto this material, which could be collagen or whatever else. And so the real question is, can we start comparing some of the shapes and morphologies and architectures we see in these disorganization experiments with what happens to the interfaces in these sort of calculations? Doing this in the red dots. The red sphere. Let's see what happens. That's just one particular of these bubbles. And I don't, in fact, know what the red one is. I would have to ask Jamie what the red one is. I see. I don't know. These are sort of fluid tracers in the water. I don't know what the red one is. I totally need to ask him. So here's doing this in three dimensions. And again, inertia clearly is turned up here, and gravity is turned up here, and so forth. But the basic upshot is that some of the there have been real advances on the algorithm and calculation side that if you give us pathology slides, pictures, or movies, we can begin to think about inverting those data to give you time trajectory of mechanical abnormalities that must have occurred to explain why the interfaces are moving, why the cell shape is changing in the way that a pathologist would recognize as being quote-unquote bad. And so this does require a large computer, but you know, the way Moore's law works, this will become easier soon. So now turning our attention to these lines of collagen, we can use very similar computational techniques to directly calculate what should happen if I place three contractile objects onto a material with nonlinear elasticity, and you immediately observe also this line formation. And this is so idiot-proof, it's amazing. We can play with parameters almost at will, and this is a very, very reliable architecture that emerges. And the key thing is the nonlinearity of collagen mechanics. Again, nothing I've told you so far allows you to assess whether this matters or is interesting or relevant or something like that. And the next step, of course, is now to go to real tissues and ask whether we can find similarly misarranged collagen architectures. Here's an example of a 7 by 7 millimeter piece of breast tissue, also imaged with a quantitative polarization technique. And now the question is, can we find similar regions of abnormal collagen architectures? Here are some possible implications, all of which can easily be entirely incorrect. One of the starting points for all these studies were actually conversations with a surgeon who had a very simple question. Okay, so what's the tumor margin? And so if it's true that tumors are mechanically remodeling or manipulating the extracellular matrix, it turns out to be actually very hard to even define this notion of a margin, because what we're dealing with here are regions of inappropriate matrix architecture which can propagate over millimeters through a tissue. And so where does the surgeon cut, right? So what about treatment? We know that if you take a stable structure and place it on something which is inappropriately hardened, then it will disorganize. What if you kill all the cells? Well, the extracellular matrix is a viscoelastic material which can remember, figuratively speaking, particular architectures. And so are those regions of inappropriate architecture sites of reinitiation? And so here's a more general notion. So what do we have to do to get these patterns to form? The first thing is, and I haven't told you this, we're dealing with mammary acini that have a RAS mutation. So these are MCF10AT. So there's a lot of genetics going on here. We have to get the system to the point where it begins to inappropriately respond to particular cues. And then, if we also change those external signals in exactly the right way, then we can get some of these structures to form. And there's a spatial component here. So what do you need to make this pattern? Okay, you need at least one hit RAS, number one. But what else do you need? If your mammary acini is far away from all other contractile mammary acini, very little happens. So there's a second hit, and that's a spatial hit. If there's a second one relatively close by that's also contractile, then a line of hardened collagen forms, and then acini disorganize more quickly compared to them being isolated. So here's an example of where there's a clear genetic element to the disorganization, but there's also a spatial element to this organization, just the overlap of these radial transport fields. And one of the general questions is now, how do we begin to test those questions in the context of real tissue? And I'm totally out of my depth when it comes to that. What's the next big step? So obviously what you want to do is now begin to relate what we know about the immune system and about stemness and genes and phenotypes and epigenetics to mechanics. It's fortunate that a lot of the proteins and pathways people know and love are now appreciated to actually also be involved in mechanosensing. This is true for ROROC, EGFR, ERP2, P38, PI3 kinase, ERKMEC, Notch, Wnt, limb kinase, and TGF-beta signaling, as well as epigenetics. So all those things have a day job in mechanosensing, so I think it'll be very interesting to start creating more explicitly these connections. So back to where we started, this high-level trend of personalization. One of the things that is clear due to work by many, many people who are much better and more knowledgeable about this than I will ever be, is that intracellular cancer signaling is significantly modulated by the cell's environment. And now you can think about this as a big, big headache or as an opportunity. And of course, I'm a proponent for thinking about this as an opportunity, especially considering this observation. So inhibiting collagen cross-linking normalizes high PI3 kinase, ERK, and various other aberrant signaling. And so by normalizing the outside, you can also normalize the inside in interesting ways. And so I think it's important to sort of contemplate whether it makes sense to think about explicitly targeting or normalizing the mechanics of ECM as one of the many ways of trying to treat cancer. And again, I'm totally out of my depth here. Remember, I come at this from a polymer physics viewpoint, so please take this with an enormous grain of salt. Thank you for your attention, and thank all of my colleagues for actually providing the content of this talk. Thank you.